and welcome back to Invest Africa Insights. Creating the largest free trade area in the world, the African Continental Free Trade Agreement came into force in January of this year. The promises from policymakers are huge, a market of 1.2 billion people with a combined GDP of over $3 trillion, and a 15 to 20% increase in intra-Africa trade by 2040. However, with many issues yet to be agreed, non-tariff barriers and weak infrastructure still hindering progress, and COVID-19 disrupting trade and undermining growth, the road ahead will be long and challenging. To help us unpack where the African Continental Free Trade Agreement is now, what it can achieve in the short term, and where it is heading, I'm delighted to welcome back to the programme Jacques Nel, Head of African Macroeconomics at NKC African Economics. Jacques, welcome back.
Thank you. Thanks for the invitation.
So Jacques, perhaps to start us off, you could just briefly explain for those who maybe don't know what the scope of the African Continental Free Trade Agreement is on paper before we move into talking about some of the challenges of implementation.
Sure, no problem. I just want to start off by saying this is a really refreshing initiative. The commencement of the agreement coincided with the UK stumbling out of the EU. And as the US is trying to mend ties with its trade partners after some pretty difficult years. So as you mentioned, the agreement attempts to create a single market in Africa for goods to flow freely from country to country. And this then addresses some key macroeconomic and geopolitical issues that the continent has faced, still continues to face. Just from an economic perspective, market size has always been an issue for Africa, and this agreement could then create the economies of scale needed to attract foreign investment. And then from a geopolitical perspective, this could also benefit Africa's negotiating power. And that's when it comes to trade negotiations with external partners. And then also there's the hope that closer economic collaboration could encourage just general could encourage political unity in other respects as well. But I do think we have to be realistic about the project so that we don't get disappointed or disillusioned. The January 1st commencement was largely a symbolic milestone. Negotiations on tariffs and rules of origin still have to be concluded, which will undoubtedly prove to be very complex. And even if negotiations do make progress on the tariff front, as you mentioned, there are numerous other non-tariff challenges that I think we'll get into a bit later. And the timing also, you know, tempers optimism a bit. The aim of the agreement is to reduce 90% of tariffs to zero for developing economies by 2025, but it aims to drop 90% of tariffs for least developed countries to zero by 2030 only. So this means that not only will the implementation be a challenge, but even if goals are achieved, it could take a decade to see broad-based results from, and that's from a merchandise trade perspective.
So yeah, as you say, there's sort of two parallel timelines here. You know, there's a long-term outlook over the decade, and then there's sort of what needs to be achieved in the shorter term. So looking perhaps at just some of those outstanding issues, what do you see as the most sort of pressing issues, whether that's part of the agreement or whether that's around investment and infrastructure? What do you see as the most pressing issues yet to be resolved?
Well, just from a negotiation perspective, agreeing on which tariffs to reduce when will prove to be very challenging. You know, if you consider the various economic structures on the continent, so certain countries are going to be wanting to protect certain industries and keep tariffs there, while others would be viewing those industries as the ones where they could actually benefit and by exporting their goods there. So that's going to prove very challenging. And then there's the rules of origin, which is central to the agreement, but will again be very complex given the range of products that the agreement is targeting. And then current supply chains could then prove to be an issue when coming up with the rules of origin, because a lot of them would then have to be dislodged as, you know, as we try to source inputs from Africa and then produce goods in Africa for Africa. Then just as again, the non-tariff barriers, infrastructure is the most clear one of them. I took a look and it's not very scientific, but just a way to look at this is if you do a Google Maps search and see how long it would take for the 1,500 kilometer trip between Paris and Rome, which is expected to take around 15 hours by car. If you go that same distance between Mombasa in Kenya and Kigali in Rwanda, it's expected to take 26 hours. So in addition to this lack of transport infrastructure, we've also got corruption and inefficiencies at border posts, which could prove challenging as well. There's the potential for opposition from existing regional economic communities. At the moment, trade and integration might also not be a top priority for a lot of governments, given the fiscal pressures that they're under. And then, of course, also at the moment, you know, the COVID-19 restrictions are still in place in a lot of countries, and we don't know how long these are going to be in place and how that's going to stifle trade integration going forward.
And you mentioned that existing economic communities, and obviously Africa has a number of existing free trade areas. Are there any lessons that you can see to be learned from those existing sub-regional trading blocks like COMESA and ECOWAS that could be applied to some of these challenges that we're talking about?
Yes, I think there are a few positive and negative takeaways that you can learn from existing blocks. On the bad news front, COMESA kind of just shows how difficult it actually is to get a trade block going. That's because at the moment, COMESA is less than half the countries on the continent, but it hasn't been able to produce the structural transition that we are hoping to see, especially for smaller countries like Rwanda, which hasn't got the market size, but being part of the East African community is a significant draw card from an investment perspective, again, because of the economies of scale that a bloc provides. But even there in the East African community, we've seen how frictions between governments intermittently flare up, and these then result in temporary, most of the time, trade tensions between member countries. And then we also see the difficulty in collaborating when it comes to negotiations with external countries. Again, in the East African community, we've seen the question of, you know, if the East African community negotiates as a bloc with Europe, Kenya is considered or is not considered a least developed country, but the rest of the countries in the bloc are. So what does that then mean for negotiations between the two blocs? And then, from a positive perspective, or some of the positive lessons we've learned from existing blocs, is that it is possible to create pockets of progress, like we've seen in the East African community. You know, the trade has increased a lot over time, especially between certain countries. And we can then learn best practices from these bilateral or inter-block negotiations or practices, and then apply these on a broader spectrum to more countries. And then just broadly speaking, you know, taking a continent-wide trade bloc into account, the trade bloc's going to be a lot less susceptible to regional slumps, perhaps driven by adverse weather or commodity slumps. So a country will be able to benefit from growth elsewhere in the continent, even if countries in its immediate region are under pressure due to various reasons. This could also be due to the economic anchor driving down regional trade, like South Africa and SADC or Nigeria and ECOWAS. You know, a small neighboring country next to South Africa doesn't necessarily have to go down with South Africa if South Africa is going through a slump, if it is part of a broader trade bloc and can benefit from stronger growth elsewhere in the continent.
And there's sort of an interesting tension in what you're describing there, which is sort of, on the one hand, you've got different sized economies in trade blocks, and you've got to be able to account for it. And on the other hand, you know, the sort of the sell is that being part of this wider bloc is beneficial, even to those least developed economies. So my question is, do you think enough is being done with the African Continental Free Trade Agreement to sort of, obviously, some countries will find themselves maybe losing out in the shorter term or not seeing the benefits as quickly as others that are more integrated and sort of prepared for the, for this kind of trading arrangement. So do you see any work being done to make sure that that there aren't tensions created that could sort of boil over into derailing the project as a whole?
Yes, there's definitely going to be some adjustment costs, and at least initially, and most likely over the medium term, they're going to be clear winners and clear losers. But I do think, and of course, the current fiscal position these countries are facing is a concern, especially over the short to medium term, because the governments will be unwilling to endure the short-term adjustment costs that will take the loss of tariffs. Again, some countries are really dependent on tariffs at the moment for fiscal revenue, others less so. But a trade block like this will require buy-in from most countries at least. So just coordinating that and taking into consideration those countries' fiscal positions and their unwillingness to let go of their tariffs is again going to be a very complex issue to navigate. But that being said, I did see now recently that the African Export-Import Bank and the AU are working together to put together an adjustment facility to actually compensate a lot of these countries that are seeing a reduction in revenue directly attributed to the loss of tariffs, or which are expected to see a loss of revenue. This could, of course, help a lot, and it could hasten the process a bit. But again, just broadly speaking, at the moment, given how economies suffered last year and given weak fiscal balance sheets, we could see protectionism shore up, protectionism rise in an attempt to shore up revenue as governments try to protect their cash cow sectors that are either producing jobs or just encouraging economic activity, or of course, just significant fiscal revenue sources.
You've started to touch on it there and sort of earlier, but it'd be interesting, I think, to delve into a bit more detail around some of these shorter-term macroeconomic challenges caused in large part by COVID, but were also, you know, there to an extent before. So I suppose maybe to stay on the sort of debt issue, but then we can move out to talk about the economic environment more broadly. How much of a threat do you think debt distress is to the project, and which countries are you most sort of concerned about in the short term from a debt perspective?
Yes, I think, as I said, I think fiscal positions or fiscal concerns are going to be quite a stumbling block, especially over the short to medium term. Last year, we saw fiscal balances surge and public debt surge as governments had to pick up spending. And of course, revenue sources collapsed due to the collapse in their economies. But this is quite a difficult one because the Debt Service Support Initiative, or the DSSI, and the G20's Common Framework for Debt Treatment, these are two initiatives implemented over the past year, and they've provided critical support to numerous countries. So I think to identify which countries are at risk of debt distress, we have to look at which countries would be hesitant to partake in these programs. And that's either because of the implications for their credit ratings or what this means for future access to international debt markets. And countries that spring up when considering this include Kenya. There we've seen their consolidation drive show very little progress over the past few years, and they've had an on-off relationship with the IMF. From a political perspective, we should also note that we're moving towards the end of President Kenyatta's legacy term, which also means that spending restraint is going to be unlikely. And Kenya also basically blew open its public debt ceiling, I think it was last year or the year before that, from 50% of GDP to a nominal value, which almost matched that of GDP in 2019. So there's not going to be any regulation in the way of increasing public debt at the moment. And then also just considering that public debt servicing will equate to nearly 3% of GDP this year. So just considering that fiscal position and considering their likely unwillingness to partake in some of those debt relief initiatives, especially preemptively, we could see a lot of pressures there. And then just one more country to mention also is Ghana. Ghana is reportedly also looking to tap international debt markets this year. So again, might not preemptively make use of the DSSI initiative or the common framework facilities. There we've also seen public debt soaring, reaching nearly 90% of GDP last year. Interest payments equated to around 50% of revenue last year, which means its debt's pretty expensive. And debt servicing there is also expected to equate to around 3% of GDP this year. So, you know, it's got a lot of debt to pay off. It's quite expensive. Its public debt surged, and it's unlikely to make use of those facilities soon. So I think, just broadly speaking, in the East, we expect to keep an eye on Kenya, and in the West, keep an eye on Ghana, just to see how those fiscal situations or how they ride out this fiscal storm, basically, over the next few years.
So obviously COVID-19 has had an economic impact, which we've spoken about. But when you have these sort of crisis moments and moments of economic hardship, you know, you often see alongside that social unrest and political instability, and, you know, regional integration is a political project as much as it's an economic one. So from a political perspective, what trends are you watching closely at the moment?
Well, a country we've been keeping an eye on is, and I think everybody's been keeping an eye on it, is Nigeria. There, last year, we saw successive waves of social unrest. It's the NSARS movement started initially as protests against police brutality, but then that morphed into protests over bad governance in general. There's also insecurity in the northeast and northwest. We've seen flare-ups in separatist sentiment in Biafra, which then threatens to bring instability to the economically important Delta region. And this is all the more concerning when you consider that President Buhari was elected to a large extent on a security ticket. So considering that, and then also on the economic side, the economic situation is not going to help at all. Inflation has been trending higher last year, especially food price inflation. And unemployment has also more than doubled. The unemployment rate has also more than doubled over the past 3 years. So we can expect, last year we already saw a lot of social unrest. Things don't look like they're going to improve much this year. So I think Nigeria is definitely a country to keep an eye on for social unrest and what that then means for the broader economy and political environment in general.
And do you think those sorts of dynamics, you know, especially in an economy like Nigeria, which, you know, huge strategic importance. Will that impact the free trade agreement over the longer term, or do you see it more as a shorter term stumbling block?
Yes, I think some of the larger economies almost have to buy into the agreement for it to make sense. You know, you're not going to have an Africa free trade agreement without Nigeria, and domestic politics there is going to going to have a big impact on Nigeria's decision and willingness and almost vigor with which it, you know, partakes in this project. So that's going to be very important to get all the big countries on board. But then again, you know, just from a regional perspective, we've also seen tensions between countries. For instance, if we look at Ethiopia, what's happening there in the Tigray region and the tensions that's caused with Ethiopia and Sudan. You know, that complicates measures that require certain countries to make concessions to other countries and their willingness to make concessions and, you know, just willingness to collaborate with each other. That just kind of puts it into perspective, trying to get what I think it's 54 countries now to work together and agree on anything is going to be complicated. But then to agree on measures such as this that are going to have immediate short-term impacts, a lot of them negative, on their domestic economies is going to make it even more challenging. And then when considering the political implications And, you know, there's never a time when there's no social unrest or conflict somewhere in Africa. So there's never going to be a good time. So it's always going to be challenging. So that just kind of puts it into context, you know, the immense challenge that lays ahead. But that being said, it's all worth it.
So, you know, we've spoken about some of the sort of more immediate challenges and the long-term reward that you were alluding to there. But I'm just curious as to whether you see any short-term rewards that could be taken advantage of in the, you know, in the short to medium term from the agreement.
Yes. Well, I think often underappreciated aspect of the trade agreement is the trade in services. That also forms part of the agreement. And, you know, services can either be traded directly or can serve as an input into the production process. So that means there could be a lot of positive second round effects from that. And it should be noted that the gains from the agreement, from our perspective, will be through increased trade facilitation and a reduction in non-tariff barriers. So not just the drop in tariffs. So, and yeah, service could, of course, play a significant role in facilitating trade, not just from a regulatory perspective, you know, dotting all the T's and crossing the I's, or crossing the T's and dotting the I's and all the documentation that you need to trade. But also, you know, the expansion of services in themselves, like financial services. If trade does increase significantly, there's going to be a significant increase in demand for trade financing. That's where a lot of these bigger banks can expand and, you know, fill that void, could increase financial penetration. And just generally, the expansion of trade in financial services, ICT, education, and just business services in general could benefit the continent much quicker than an increase in trade in tangible goods.
Do you think that particularly in terms of financial services, the sort of is the regulatory alignment there, or is it coming for that to really take off? I see what you're saying, more quickly than those areas where you need to invest in physical infrastructure over a longer period.
Yes, that doesn't mean it's not going to be challenging, but the trade and services aren't hindered by infrastructural or logistical deficits. I also think the benefits are going to be a lot clearer for a lot of the smaller countries as well. You know, it's not going to be some of the bigger countries, for instance, Kenya, have much more sophisticated financial sectors than other countries in the region. But those other countries stand to benefit a lot quicker from the expansion of those services into those countries. And, you know, as opposed to the expansion of Kenya's manufacturing, you know, countries importing manufactured goods or countries importing Kenyan manufactured goods is going to have a negative effect initially, at least on those manufacturing sectors, where services not so much. And the expansion of services has some symbiotic effects on other economic activities, facilitating economic activity in general. So I think countries will be a lot more willing to open their borders to services imports than what they are to, you know, goods imports.
So do you think then that some of those countries that do have some, you know, the stronger financial centers and the more sort of established financial services should be looking to establish themselves as sort of regional hubs, regional champions for those kind of services?
Yes, definitely. Countries like, again, like Kenya have tried to position themselves as regional services and trade hubs. And, you know, and that was within the East African community initially, but this trade agreement potentially opens up the entire continent. There's going to be, of course, a lot more competition from South Africa and Egypt and other countries with sophisticated financial sectors. But there's definitely a lot more to gain from these countries being able to expand their services. And again, other countries will be a lot more willing to receive those services because it's going to benefit their domestic economies a lot more and a lot quicker.
I'm sure listening to this, Jack, so people will be thinking, you know, so now sort of what do investors do with this information in this landscape? So to sort of to wrap us up, it'd be really great to hear from you. I suppose first, let's maybe start with the short-term play. If you were making a shorter to medium-term investment, you know, we've talked about services. Where would you be? Where would you be advising investors to look now in terms of sort of sectors and markets to take advantage of some of the growth that may come out of continental free trade?
Oof. Again, that's a difficult one, but I think I think services is the sector to look at. The actual trade in goods, it's going to be very difficult to time that because you'll have to first time where it's going to be happening, which countries, which sectors. So I think definitely to look at services. And I do see that there has been quite a lot of interesting things happening in logistical e-services. As you know, again, this comes down to companies facilitating trade between countries, which is going to be, you know, if trade increases, or this is going to be one of the key drivers behind trade increasing. So a lot of these e-logistical tech companies that, you know, just make trade easier by providing market information, and then the more worrying detailed stuff, you know, the paperwork to get things across borders. I think those companies could do very good going forward before a lot of the other country or companies or sectors benefit from greater trade. Trade and services, and services that facilitate trade, are going to do really good.
And over the longer term trajectory, you know, thinking about that 2040 goal for intra-Africa trade, where would you be advising people to look?
Well, I think one of the key goals of the overall trade agreement is to increase value addition in Africa. So Africa produces what Africa consumes, and we don't export raw material and import goods. So I would think that sectors or countries that have strong manufacturing bases and that are positioned to fill that void, or, you know, be in front of the queue when it comes to expanding manufacturing capabilities to replace exports or imports from countries outside of Africa, those countries already are in a good position to benefit from increased demand in Africa for manufactured goods. But if trade barriers drop, and perhaps if external, you know, communal external barriers go up, making goods from outside of Africa more expensive, those countries will be able to benefit by servicing Africa's demand and growing demand for manufactured goods.
Jacques, thanks so much for coming on today and, you know, helping us sort of understand a very complex but potentially very beneficial process. So thank you for sharing your insights.
Thanks for the invite.